Welcome to another edition of the 51%, Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Melissa Silverstein is one very busy and accomplished woman. She's a writer, lecturer, founder and editor of Women in Hollywood, one of the most respected and go-to blogs regarding issues connected to women in film, as well as other areas of pop culture. She also happens to be the artistic director and co-founder of the Athena Film Festival at New York City's Barnard College. This year marks number 4. We'll have much more on that in a moment. Melissa's recent book, In Her Voice, Women Directors Talking Directing, is an outgrowth of Women in Hollywood. She's also a columnist for Forbes.com, and her work's been featured on CNN, the BBC, in Newsweek, Salon, the New York Times, and numerous other publications. She's worked on social media marketing campaigns and events for a variety of movies, as well as on several high-profile public campaigns, including Take Our Daughters to Work Day. She was the founding project director for the White House Project and was also the chief of staff at the Ms. Foundation for Women. Honors and awards. Melissa was one of the recipients of the 2013 Susan B. Anthony Award from the New York City chapter of Now. Women in Hollywood was named one of the top 100 websites for women by Forbes Woman in 2011, 12, and 13. There are more, but I just want to welcome Melissa and start asking questions. Good grief, woman, you have some resume. When did your professional career begin? In middle school, for God's sake?
No, I've been doing this for over 20 years. I always say to people, when you work for yourself for a number of years, you can cut off some of the wear and tear of going to and from an office, and so you kind of look a little younger.
So take us on the journey from college, let's say, to your work on women's issues. What came first, the Ms. Foundation?
Well, actually, when I left college, I went directly to grad school at Columbia University, and I studied theater management. And I loved theater my whole life. When I grew up close to the city on Long Island, and I took the train in by myself and went to see these shows, and it was my thing. I loved theater. So I decided I was going to study theater and I wanted to be a producer. And it was terrific. But then when I started working in the world of theater, I realized very quickly that it was not for me and it was going to make me miserable. And so I kind of did a pivot and I wound up in Gloria Steinem's office at the Ms. magazine. And one day there, the woman who was in charge said, you know, there's this thing happening down at the Ms. Foundation, and Gloria mentioned it in Parade magazine, and now they're inundated with stuff. So we're going to send you down to the Ms. Foundation, and you're going to work on Take Our Daughters to Work Day, and we'll go from there. And I was like, okay, sure, no problem. So I wound up at the Ms. Foundation for the first year of Take Our Daughters to Work Day. There were like 3 people in a fax machine.
What year was that?
I would say it was probably 2002.
Okay.
Or 2003. And then it just, you know, I just loved working there. I loved the project. I loved the energy. I loved that I could have my feminism be alive and
productive.
Uh-huh. And so I stayed on and got a job at the Ms. Foundation. And, you know, I've been doing this a long time. It was the days when we didn't all have computers at our desk.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked my way up in the organization for a decade, finished there working directly with the president the whole time I was there, wound up at the chief of staff. And then one day, Maurice E. Wilson kind of walked into the office and she's like, I have this other idea. This project about, you know, women running for office. And I was just like, okay, sure. In my youngness, my youth, I said, sure, whatever you need, whatever you want to do. And kind of that's how the White House Project was born. And really one of the things that I brought to the White House Project that is about my work now is the importance of culture and reaching people where they are.
Let me interrupt, and I would like you to describe the White House Project for those who may not know about it.
The White House Project was a project that asked people to think about the fact that we had so few women in leadership positions up to the top level, the presidency of the United States. So basically, it was another public education campaign like Take Our Daughters to Work Day, which really posited the question and asked people to think about things a little bit differently. And put women, the first thing we did was put this ad in People magazine, which was 10, 12 women in history who had potential to be president of the United States and make them think differently.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what the White House Project was.
And did that propel a lot of women to what? Either
go into public office or have the population elect more women?
Well, there were several incarnations of the White House project. After it was, you know, the bigger question, it then got down to business and really started training women. So, yes, it did have an effect. Mm-hmm. I was no longer working on that kind of that work at that time. But they did train women at the local level. But what the White House project did before anyone else was make people think about women who could be president.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about the way you engage people is that you have to go to the places where they're comfortable. And people are really comfortable in television and movies. And when you put out a strong female character in a television show, or especially a movie, it helps them think about things a little bit differently.
Sure, it sets the ball rolling in their heads.
And it's very safe to do that. So one of the things we always did with the White House Project was to use culture and to use the way people connect with each other as a way to get them to think about things differently. So that work, while it had no name at that time, is basically Women in Hollywood. It was the beginnings. It was the seeds of Women in Hollywood.
That laid the foundation for you to start.
It did. It did. And while I didn't realize, you know, all of that at the time, that thinking of, you know, reaching people and talking to people about the importance of having diversity of voices in entertainment was started back then.
And when you think about it, nobody thought about it back then. It was just de rigueur. It was the way it was. You know, women, whether they were presence in front of the camera, they certainly weren't a presence behind the camera.
Well, yes. And I think that there's been cycles of Hollywood. And like in the early days of Hollywood, and if you read Carrie Beacham's fantastic book on Frances Marion called Without Lying Down, you will get a sense that women really had a lot of power in early Hollywood. They were writers. They were directors.
Really?
Yes. Very much so. But it was also a small industry then, and it wasn't a lot of money. And as the industry grew and banks became involved and people realized they can make a lot of money at this, the men started pushing the women out.
Hmm.
And so there's really a great period of time in the early years of Hollywood where you have very strong, creative women who basically laid the foundation for the future. Then you have fallow years where there are very few women, especially behind the scenes. There were always women writing. There were always great, strong parts for women on screen. I mean, think about the Lauren Bacall years, the Katharine Hepburn years,
right.
The Bette Davis years. Those were always amazing women. And men and women all went to see these movies together. There was never kind of this gender divide about movies. As the 60s and 70s rolled along, it became more male-centric, more blockbuster-centric. I mean, the blockbuster stuff started in the late 70s, early 80s, and there were very few women directors. It was like a handful of directors in the early 80s that were women. And women started getting jobs in Hollywood, you know, at the studios. And then people were noticing that women were missing. It was also a time period when feminism was kind of like picking up in the 70s and 80s when people were making movies about strong female characters. Men and women were looking at what was happening in our culture, and it was being reflected on screen. So you had like a Norma Rae, and you had Silkwood.
Right.
You had amazing women on screen that was the norm. These were the movies that were the best movies of the year. These are the movies that everybody went to see. These are the movies that were talked about. And then in the 90s, it's kind of just women started disappearing from the screen. The strong female characters just kind of disappeared as the blockbuster ascended.
So they were replaced again by the shoot 'em up kind of, or Star Warsy kind of movies.
There was always a place in the earlier years where it was the Western, and then there was always the quote unquote woman's picture. And Jeanine Basinger writes about that really well. But it seemed that as multiplexes started to grow and studios became really focused on more of these tentpole movies, what the word tentpole means, they're holding up the rest of the tent because they make so much money. Even at that time, there was, you know, Nora Ephron making movies. You had Nancy Myers making movies. They would get money for movies. Their movies would make money. But then all those movies that were made at the kind of $30 to $40 million range, they called them the mid-level movies. And if they made $67 million, they were happy. They just kind of disappeared. Then when the DVD market crashed, it became like micro budgets and $100 million movies.
So what did you hope to accomplish with Women in Hollywood, which started off, what, not as a blog initially, did it?
Yeah, I was kind of like in the middle of blogging. There were people who were way, way, way ahead of me technologically. I was working at the Women's Media Center then, and one of my duties was to put together an update each day of news from around the world. And I was always looking for entertainment news, and there was nothing. There was nothing about feminism and Hollywood and entertainment that I really wanted to read. And I thought if I felt that way, other people felt that way. I also felt as I was getting older, there were fewer and fewer movies that I wanted to see. So I felt like if this is happening to me, it's got to be happening to other people. And what's going on here? So I just kind of started one day, came up with this name. I was like, I'm going to just do this. So I started this blog, and it was pretty awful at the beginning. It was a lot of links. I didn't write anything. I just didn't have a sense of what I was doing. Then I went to like a blogging conference, and all these guys were talking about making money on their blogs. And I was like, oh my God, that's so cool. And it was just, you can't make a blog by yourself. You can't make money blogging. As an independent blogger, you can make money if you're a staff person at a blog.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a whole different story. And I knew pretty much that it's not like when you write about feminism in Hollywood, it's not like people are beating down the door to
exactly
buy your blog. So I was just like, okay, well, I got to figure this out. And there were a couple of very kind of like years where I was just like, what am I doing?
But you had a full-time job, so this was something that you did on the side.
I actually did not have a full-time job. I've been consulting for many years, and I had a couple of consulting gigs, but it was also the recession and there's just not a lot going on. And I was just trying to figure this out, and then had been doing some marketing events for films and did this event for the film Bright Star that Jane Campion directed. And this woman, Katie Colbert, who I had known from my days at the Ms. Foundation, came to this event, and she had just started the Athena Center for Leadership Studies at Barnard College. And she was looking for projects that her center could do that could highlight women's leadership. And so she's at this event, and afterwards we kind of had this little brainstorm, and she's like, why don't we do a film festival? And
let's put on a play.
Exactly. And I was like, well, I've put on plays before, so let's try. So we got a little grant to explore this and just went for it and just, you know, throw the spaghetti and see what sticks. And this kind of stuck immediately, and it has grown. The partnership really works well because there's an institution, Barnard College, there's venues. We bring in technical enhancements to all these locations on campus to make them into screening rooms. But really, it's transforming the college into this one weekend into a film festival venue.
So that helped propel Women in Hollywood to great heights, because it really is quite a blog site in 2014, right? Are you stunned by that?
I think a lot of the people that I have met through my work at Women in Hollywood participate in the festival because they know me. And then the exposure of the film festival helps give me credibility. So it's a win-win all around.
So what's the point of Women in Hollywood?
I think there are multiple points for Women in Hollywood. Firstly, Women in Hollywood is, it's different than a blog. It's not just a blog. What we say is we agitate, advocate, and educate people about the issues of women in the entertainment business. So really our focus is enhancing the voices of women in this business, because they get snuffed out really quickly. One of the things I did really quickly when I started Women in Hollywood was start talking to women directors. And I live in New York.
That must not have taken very long.
Exactly. And I started writing about the movies, but then I'd say to the press people, I want to talk to this woman. I want to talk to this director. I want to start doing interviews. And then I just became the person who would talk to these women. And then I, you know, just continued to talk to women and talk to women and talk to women and support women. And then all of a sudden I realized I had, you know, 50 interviews with people that were sitting on this website that no one was going to see again. And if we wanted to change the image of what a director was, we had to figure out how to put more women's voices out there. Because if you ask a kid what a director is, they always tell you a Steven Spielberg-like person.
Sure.
So really, and this is, again, goes back to kind of the White House Project stuff, is like you have to put enough people out there. You have to create a critical mass so that people see women for all their opportunities and all see women with all their assets out there.
But The Women in Hollywood was initially just about female directors?
It wasn't just about female directors,
right.
But that was the piece that made me unique. And so I decided to put together all the interviews into this book so that I would have something to, a calling card for people. Now, I mean, blogging is taken more seriously, but it's so I, but at the time it was kind of like, so you write a blog, big deal.
So it started to build.
It started
slowly.
And then when I went on to IndieWire about 3 years ago, it gave me a whole another level of acceptance in the industry.
So this is your primary means of earning a living.
The Athena Film Festival is my primary means of earning a living.
But there are other people who write for Women in Hollywood. It's not
That's
just
correct.
You.
Women in Hollywood is also has supporters. So I have somebody who invests in the work of Women in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I'm able to pay people who write for it.
And how often do new articles go up?
Multiple times a day.
And I read one about the good and the bad among the 2014 Oscar nominees. 2013 was an even worse than usual year for non-acting women in Hollywood. Only 6% of the 250 top-grossing films were directed by female filmmakers and just 10% written by female screenwriters. So it's no surprise to us that there's little to celebrate about this year's nominees. Well, that's a real kick in the teeth, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, those statistics are not done by us. Those statistics are done by an academic institution in California called the Center for Study of Women in Television and Film at San Diego State University. And every year, come early January, Dr. Martha Lausen releases this comprehensive study that she's been doing for like 16 years now, I think. And basically, women directors cannot get above 10%. They just cannot get any traction in Hollywood. And so last year was 9%. Everybody was like, great. Now it's down to 6%. Yet people think things are great because we are having a large cultural conversation about this on the internet and other places. So people think things are great because but they're not looking at the numbers. So this is where I'm struggling with now with my work is kind of like these numbers don't change. And the conversation is definitely at a higher level. What do we do next?
What do we do next?
I don't have an answer for that. This is the work of Women in Hollywood in 2014, which is what do we do next? And I'm working, you know, with somebody who's going to help me figure this out because all the newspapers are writing about the lack of opportunities for women in multiple positions. And cinematography is even worse. It's 2%. There just needs to be a kickstart of this. And I'm trying to figure out what goes on next.
You know, some years, like The Hurt Locker, which won the best movie directed by Kathryn Bigelow. So that's like, that's so huge. And then, you know, and you focus on that and then that just sort of fades away like bad breath, you know.
For the fantastic work that she did in that movie, she is still the one and everybody, you can't hold one person up as the poster child.
For
an entire industry. It's too much and it's really not right. We need critical mass so that women can fail, so that women can do different kinds of jobs, so they're not pigeonholed into the rom-com genre. And so many things need to be done on this. And there is really no will from the people who run the industry to shake it up and see it change. They're quite content.
So is that one of the goals of the Athena Film Festival?
See, the Athena Film Festival is different from some other women's film festivals in that we show films directed by men and women. All the movies that we show at the Athena Film Festival all have at their core a women's leadership film theme. So what we're trying to do is make people see how awesome these movies are with strong women on screen.
But how do they get mass marketed? I mean, a film festival is one thing, but, you know, 40 million people don't go to a film festival.
That is correct. Now, a lot of our movies are not mass market movies, but some of them are. Some of them have played in theaters. Some of them have played at film festivals. Some of them have been nominated for Oscars. Some of them are shorts that you would never have seen had the Athena Film Festival not put them together.
Mm-hmm.
All different kinds of things. What we do is we curate an entire program. We don't have tons of premieres. We have a couple of great ones this year.
Why don't you tell us about some of them?
This year we have an opening film. It's a New York premiere, and it's called Belle. And it's directed by a woman named Amma Asante. It's a period piece. It's a British film. Going to be released by Fox Searchlight here in the United States in May. Now, the story of Belle is based on a true story of a young woman of mixed race who lived in Britain during the slave trade and how she became involved in helping end slavery in England. But it's also a story of women who get lost in history. And so we're very excited to have this piece start off our film festival. And the director, Amma Asante, who is an up-and-comer, is coming to the festival. So we're very excited. Our centerpiece film is a film called Decoding Annie Parker, also based on some true events about two different women who didn't know each other, but were all both on the quest to understand why people get breast cancer. Annie Parker, real true woman, had a family history take place in the 70s and 80s. Family history, everyone in her family is dying of breast cancer. She had cancer multiple times. She, as a layperson, kind of starts figuring out that this is not just happening to her and her family. This is hereditary. They have genes that are being passed along. At the same time, Mary Claire King, who is an amazing genetic researcher in Washington, who's also a real person, is in her lab with her team trying to figure out why breast cancer is happening the way it is, and they discover the hereditary stuff, and all the kind of male establishment of cancer refuses to say that there's any hereditary relationship with cancer. Helen Hunt plays Mary Claire King. Samantha Morton plays Annie Parker. And this is like an amazing story of women who just will not be stopped.
And this is also directed by a man.
This is directed by a man, Steve Bertzny, who took him, he said it took him a decade to get this made. And then our closing film is the story of a true leader who changed politics for all of us, Jerry Ferraro. And it's very interviews with Ferraro towards the end of her life and interlaced with footage of really important moments in political history. And we also have Works in Progress program. We have two programs with shorts. We have other multiple documentaries, a documentary on Alice Walker, a work in progress on amazing radical nuns. We have a documentary called American Revolutionary, The Evolution of Grace Lee Boggs, who's a 98-year-old Barnard graduate who has spent her entire life as an activist in the civil rights movement. We're going to do some discussions, one with Lema Bowie, the 2011 Nobel Peace Prize winner. And we're going to talk about the Bechdel test, which is a test that people are focused on for representation of women in film. We're going to show Lake Bell's fantastically funny film In a World. We also give out awards to women leaders in the film business. This year, we're going to be giving out the Laura Ziskin Lifetime Achievement Award to Sherry Lansing, who was one of the first women to run a studio. She was the CEO of Paramount Pictures. She is a huge leader in the industry and now dedicates herself to philanthropy. And other awardees include Callie Curry, who won an Oscar for Thelma and Louise and is now known as the creator of Nashville.
The television show.
Mm-hmm. And Nashville, the television show. And Casey Lemons, the director whose recent film was Black Nativity. And Carrie Putnam, who's the executive director of the Sundance Institute.
So this is just a huge undertaking, and I gather takes you more than a year to put together.
Well, we realize now it's a year-long activity, and we need to start right away in order for it to, be what it is. And we're all kind of perfectionists, and we all want things to be better each year. We have several movies for young people. where we encourage parents to bring the kids. We also have films where Girl Scouts come. And we really just want, I mean, this is not only for adults, this is for young people to, for them to, we talk about inspire and aspire.
What does the future hold for women in Hollywood and for you, Melissa?
I guess you kind of really have to be optimistic when you write, spend so much time thinking about an area where there is so many barriers to women. I'm optimistic because I get to meet and I get to see amazing people who are doing such great work about women. I'm as inspired by a man who wants to make a movie about a strong female character as a woman who works for 8 years on her movie to get to, you know, tell us a story about a woman who we otherwise wouldn't have known. What we're trying to do is use the Athena Film Festival to create conversations going forward. So one of the things that we did this year to kill a couple of birds with one stone was to start this thing called the Athena List, which is basically going to be three screenplays that have strong female leads that we are going to put forward and say, these are movies that you guys could put into production now. Let's have some more movies with strong female protagonists, because not only do we not have enough women directors, we don't see enough strong women on screen. It's not the 80s anymore. We do not see, there's no Norma Rae out there. There's mm-hmm. no Silkwood out mm-hmm. there. Mm-hmm. When they come along, they're small indie movies. We need big movies. This year we got very lucky in Hollywood. We had Catching Fire, Jennifer Lawrence, the number one movie of the year. There hasn't been a female protagonist as the top grossing domestic movie in Hollywood in over 40 years.
Wow.
So, and Frozen, the fantastic animated movie, is number four. We also had Gravity, which mm-hmm. is also in the top 10. Mm-hmm. What this shows is A, that female protagonists on screen make money, and B, that they make really great, that there are great movies. All those movies are directed by men.
Right.
Frozen is actually co-directed by a woman, so, and it's written by her. So what this has done is should give Hollywood like a wake-up call. They have these wake-up calls every so often, like they had for Bridesmaids, and they go, oh, women go to the movies. And then, you know, Catching Fire and Twilight, they're like, wow, women are like into movies as much as men are. I don't know why they lost that whole interest. Women buy 50% of the tickets.
Right.
It's not rocket science, yet for some reason it seems much easier for them to make movies about men. But maybe, you know, maybe things will change. But well, it's got to change in multiple ways, not just in front of the screen, but also behind the scenes. Because the statistics show that when you have more women behind the scenes, they actually hire more women on screen.
That's excellent. Well, you just keep doing it with women in Hollywood, and you just keep breathing down everybody's neck. And we'll see you at the movies. Join us for another edition of The 51%, Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.
Thanks for listening to The 51%, Conversations with Creative Women. For show comments and suggestions, please follow us on Twitter at Sandy Klein Show. You can also find us on Facebook at The 51% Conversations. The show is produced and recorded by Chad Dugatz at the Hangar Studios in New York City. Sandy Klein is our executive producer.